Okay, our topic today is going to be, is Jesus the Messiah? And only Jesus can sit on the throne of David. And I got all that inspiration from a radio station that I listen to occasionally. Southwest Radio Church, has anybody heard of that? They're a very fundamental group. But anyway, they had a guest on there. His name's John McTernan. Has anybody heard of him? Well, he wrote those books. Is Jesus of Nazareth the Messiah? Then the next one was called Is Only Jesus of Nazareth Can Sit on the Throne of David? And it was such an interesting thing that I thought maybe I'd share that as much as I could. Look at this as an introductory to this subject, because it's a deeper subject than what I can handle. But anyway, first of all, I think we ought to start with prayer. Father, we ask you to bless our study tonight, or today, and just reveal the truth to us. Amen. I thought I'd start with a bunch of familiar verses and just zip right through them, and then we'll get more into what this McTernan guy believes in a little bit. And I'm not going to look them up just because I think that you probably all have gone over these many times before in the past. One of them would be 1 Chronicles 17, verses 10 to 14, and 2 Samuel, which we will get to later, 7, verses 11 to 16. And that mention, that's the Davidic covenant, and that mentions that a son of David will be the Messiah. And then in Micah 5, verses 2 through 5, it says the Messiah will be born in Bethlehem. In Isaiah 7, verse 14, it says he'll be born of a virgin. In Isaiah 9, verses 6 and 7, it says a child will be born and a son will be given. And that kind of indicates that the Messiah is both God and man. Now, this McTernan guy is a Christian apologist, and he debates Jewish scholars and Muslim scholars. And the Jewish people refer to themselves as anti-missionaries. And their job is, when these Christian missionaries come into Israel and some Jews convert to Christianity, their job is to unconvert them. And so they'll show them from the Old Testament that Jesus cannot be the Messiah. Whereas McTernan is teaching them that he only can be the Messiah. At any rate, these Jewish anti-missionaries do not see Isaiah 9, 6, and 7 as clear enough. And that doesn't cut it for them. They believe the Messiah can still be just a man alone. In Isaiah 52, verses 13 through 15, and the whole chapter of Isaiah 53, teaches us about the substitutionary death and the resurrection of the Messiah. And all of these, again, are just qualifications that if you don't hit every one of these qualifications, you are not the Messiah. Psalm 22 mentions that the Messiah, when he dies, will have pierced hands and pierced feet. And only crucifixion is the only form of execution we know of that involves pierced hands and pierced feet. Psalm 110 tells us about the ascension. Jeremiah 31, verses 31 to 34, mentions that a new and everlasting covenant is coming. Daniel 9, verses 20 to 27, mentions the proper time frame And this is highly important as well. It's 69 weeks of years after the decree to rebuild and restore Jerusalem. And there's all sorts of starting dates on when that happened, and there's all sorts of ways of counting years. Some of them use 360-day years. Some of them use 365-day years. But no matter how you count it, it all comes up in the first half of the first century. And, of course, Jesus lived his entire lifetime in the first half of the first century. and then we got several verses, and I'm only going to mention three, but Isaiah 49, 1 through 6, Psalm 86, verse 9, and Isaiah 45, verses 22 and 25, mention that Gentiles from all over the world will worship the Jewish Messiah as God. Or they will at least worship the Jewish God. And that's happened. So whoever the Messiah is has got to meet all those qualifications. Of course, we know from our New Testament perspective that Jesus hits every one of them right on the head. But to convince these people, it's not so easy. And their main objections tend to be that, one, Jesus did not produce world peace, so he can't be the Messiah. They believe that there's a curse on Jeconiah's seed, which, by the way, they're right about that. And so that disqualifies Jesus from being the Messiah. They believe that the Messiah is not the Son of God. They do not see the Messiah as God. And we'll get into that more in here in a little bit. And the last one, and the most important one to them, is that it's obvious from Ezekiel 40 to 48 that there are sacrifices taking place in the millennial reign of the Messiah. And if that's true, then that makes the New Testament all wrong, because in Hebrews especially, but throughout the New Testament, Jesus is the ultimate sacrifice, and that there are no more sacrifices left after Jesus dies on the cross and pays the full penalty of all mankind's sin. So, how do we answer all of those objections? Well, when it comes to world peace, we would say, yet. Okay? Today is the age of grace. God is long-suffering towards humanity in this time frame, this dispensation. The Jewish people are not yet saved. They have not accepted Jesus as their Messiah, and that's one of the promises that God gave to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that their seed would be blessed through the Messiah. And the world peace that was promised, I mean, they're right about that, will not show up until the second coming of the Messiah. And they do not believe that there was a first coming. So the second objection is that there's a curse on Jeconiah's seed. Once again, they're right on the button accurate about that, but they totally misunderstand what's going on here. Let's see where that curse is. It's in Jeremiah 22, verse 24. Jeremiah 22, 24. As I live, says the Lord, through Coniah. Okay, he calls him Coniah here. And by the way, this guy, he's one of the most confusing people in the Old Testament. His original name was Jehoiachin. Then he got called Jeconiah. And here he gets called Coniah. God will not refer to this Jeconiah guy as Jeconiah because the J-E stands for Yahweh. So he pulls that portion of his name out. So, and he just refers to him as, it's a real insult towards him is what it is. But here he's called Coniah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were the signet on my right hand, yet I would pluck you off. And I will give you into the hand of those who seek your life, and into the hand of those whose face you fear, the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and the hand of the Chaldeans. So I will cast you out, and the mother who bore you into another country where you were not born, and there you will die. But to the land to which they desire to return, there they shall not return. Is this man Coniah a despised broken idol, a vessel in which is no pleasure? Why are they cast out, he and his descendants, and cast into a land which they do not know? O earth, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, write this man down as childless, a man who shall not prosper in his days, for none of his descendants shall prosper, sitting on the throne of David and ruling any more in Judah. So there's that curse, and it's on every single one of his descendants forever, including now. But now we got problems. Look at Matthew chapter 1. Because we have the genealogy of Jesus, sort of, in Matthew chapter 1. And we need to go to verse 11. Now it starts way back. Well, actually, it starts in verse 1. It starts with the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now, when you're doing genealogies, they have rules. You always start with the greatest one. So if you start with a genealogy of Jesus, you got to start with Jesus because he's the greatest one. So what Matthew does here is he starts with Jesus and works backward to Abraham. See, it says Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And he goes fast. And that's also allowed in genealogies. You can skip all the generations you want. So this is a very short genealogy of Jesus. And then he starts with Abraham in verse 2. And he says, Abraham begot Isaac, Isaac, Jacob, and on and on and on. Finally, in verse 6, you get Jesse begot David, the king. And then David, also in verse 6, begot Solomon. And then you got all these kings. And every one of these guys in verse 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, they're all kings of Judah. And they're all direct descendants of King David. And verse 11 says, Josiah begot Jeconiah and his brothers about the time they were carried away to Babylon. And after they were brought to Babylon, Jeconiah begot Shealtiel, Shealtiel Zerubbabel, and on, and finally you get down to verse 16, and it says, and Jacob begot Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called the Christ. So Joseph is a direct descendant of David, had the kingdom of David or God's kingdom on earth been set up at the time when Joseph was alive, Joseph would have been the king. But because of this curse on Jeconiah, none of the people past verse 11 ever got to be a king. Some of them lived their entire lives in Babylon. Eventually, one of them, I don't know which one, moved back to Israel. And so Joseph was born in Israel. He lived in Nazareth. And he was just a carpenter. But he was the heir to the throne. And this is where Jesus gets his right to be the heir to the throne. And you think, well, wait a minute. Jesus wasn't even really related to Joseph because of the virgin birth. But when a Jew reads this, he will read it that Joseph is his dad. And Joseph legally was his dad. But still, at the same time, the Messiah must be a descendant of David. And he gets that descendant, that human, the biological descendant from David, he gets that through his mother. And you can read about his mother's genealogy in Luke chapter 3, verses 23 all the way to 38. And we can just look at that real quickly here. But you remember the rule, you start with the greatest and work backwards. Another rule in genealogies is the older you are, the greater you are. So in a normal genealogy, you'd start with Adam and work towards the youngest people. Well, in Mary's genealogy, which begins in verse 23, it says, now Jesus himself began his ministry at about the age of 30 years of age, being as was supposed the son of Joseph, but nope, that's wrong. He's the son of Heli. Now you got to start with Jesus again because he's the greatest. So this genealogy, and only this genealogy, goes backwards. All the rest of them start with the oldest guy and work forward, but this one starts with the youngest guy and works backwards. So Heli, here's another rule in genealogies. You can skip all the girls, every one of them. And so in Mary's genealogy, they skip Mary. But anyway, Heli would have been Jesus's grandpa on Mary's side of the family. And then you trace all this back and you get down to verse 31. And it says, I'll just read the back half of 31. It says, the son of Mattathah, the son of Nathan, the son of David. So biologically, Jesus was a son of David by way of Nathan. At any rate, so how did Jesus get this right to be the to be on the throne? He got it when he went through his bar mitzvah. Did you know that Jesus had a bar mitzvah? You didn't? Well, he did. And we find it, actually, in Luke chapter 2, verse 42 to 50. And when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feast. Now, this is at Passover time. When they had finished the days, as they returned, the boy Jesus lingered behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother did not know it. But supposing him to have been in the company, they went a day's journey and sought him among their relatives and acquaintances. So when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem seeking him. Now so it was that after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions, and all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. And so when they saw him, they were amazed, and his mother said to him, son, why have you done this to us? Look, your father and I have sought you anxiously. And he said to them, why did you seek me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's business? Now what Jesus was saying there was, Joseph isn't his dad. His father is God, and he's about religion here. He's not going to be a carpenter his whole life. And what would take place in both the Jewish world and the Roman world was there would be some sort of rite of passage type of thing where you became officially an adult at age 13. Well, when you're 12, to get your bar mitzvah, you got to pass these tests by the rabbis. And if it just turns out your 13th birthday is not too far in advance around Passover time, that's the best time to have this test take place. Now, I believe Jesus was probably born in the fall, so he was a little early. But nevertheless, he and probably a bunch of other Jewish 12-year-old boys were there being tested and given the okay that, okay, you're fine, you can have your bar mitzvah. I learned this from Zola Levitt. I saw a show he did on this whole subject. It was pretty neat. And he was saying that if you were Jewish, you'd recognize it that quick, that this is just a typical bar mitzvah type of thing, and this bar mitzvah ceremony went way back. What happened was, in the Jewish world, was that when you were born to a person, to a guy, you were legally obligated to take care of that baby until his 13th birthday. And when he turned 13, if that kid was a real creep and you didn't want him as your son anymore, you could legally say, you're out of here. You're dead to me. You are not a member of my family anymore, and you are not my son. Or what happened to most of the Jewish kids was their dad would officially adopt them. And that was actually considered more important than just being born to them. And this also took place in the Roman world. The Romans did it too. I don't know if their age was 13 or if they had a specific age. But when Joseph evidently adopted Jesus at age 13, then Jesus got all the rights of a firstborn son. So legally, Jesus was the firstborn son of Joseph, because Joseph evidently did adopt him. And that's what makes him eligible to sit on the throne of David. And by the way, once those birth records were all destroyed in 70 AD, you can't point to anybody anymore. All these genealogies that we see in Matthew and Luke, they would have all been in the temple, and they would have all been recorded down through the years. And you could have went in there and read them if you wanted to. And I'm sure all the rabbis did to disprove that Jesus was the Messiah, because he was claiming to be the Messiah. And when they read the genealogy, they're like, okay, that's not a place where we can go to disprove him, because he's got the right genealogy. Okay. So anyway, this curse on Jeconiah's seed is important, because this is how God very cleverly gets around this. The curse stops at Joseph. Jesus is not under the curse, because he's not a biological descendant of Jeconiah. He's just an adopted descendant of Jeconiah. And Jeconiah was lucky. Most of the royal family was either killed or they were made eunuchs. And remember Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, they were all eunuchs because they were all members of the royal family in some way, shape, or form. When the Babylonians conquered anybody, or when anybody anywhere conquered anybody, the first thing they did was kill off the royal line so that there wouldn't be a rebellion later saying, there's our king. But Jeconiah was one of there was actually three invasions of Babylon into Jerusalem. The first one, they let Jerusalem stand. They took back hostages to Babylon, and those people were allowed to live. But then they rebelled. And so there was another invasion. They beat them in a war again, and they still let Jerusalem stand. But then Jerusalem was stupid, and they rebelled a third time, and the people in Babylon said, that's it, we're done. And they came in and they killed probably 1 million Jews, took a whole bunch of them back as slaves. And what happened in all of this was that that they played rougher every single new invasion. The first people were allowed to live. And that second group, they also took the king back, but they castrated all of his kids. And the third group, they killed all of his kids. His name was Zedekiah, and they killed every one of his kids in front of his eyes, and then poked his eyes out. So the last thing that he could see was his kids being killed. But Jeconiah was also thrown in prison. He lived in a dungeon. I'm throwing this in because I thought it was interesting. But in 2 Kings 25:27-30, it mentions that that Jeconiah wound up being a favorite of the leader of Babylon at that time. His name was Evil-Merodach. Isn't that a great name? But anyway, they hit it off with one another. Yeah, they hit it off with one another. And so Evil-Merodach said, "You don't have to stay in that prison anymore." And he gave him a pension. And he got to eat at the king's table for the rest of his life. And so they left all of his kids alone. And he had kids in Babylon. Jeconiah did. And that's where the royal line comes from. But there's a problem there, and that's because there was a curse on that line. So you were either dead, you were a eunuch, or you were cursed. And that covered every member of the royal family. But God gets around it with the virgin birth and the adoption of Jesus. Now, the third objection is that Jesus is not the Son of God. Okay. See, they don't think any of those ones that I read in the beginning were strong enough. And some of them really aren't. Like, for example, flip it over here. For example, Micah being born in Bethlehem. Well, you don't have to be God to be born in Bethlehem. And pierced hands, pierced feet. You don't have to be God to die on a cross. The ascension. You don't have to be God to be ascended up into heaven. Remember Elijah went up to heaven like that? So today's Jewish people, their rabbis today do not believe that Jesus is the Son of God. The old Jewish people, they did. And we know that from Matthew chapter 26, verses 63 and 64. It says, "Jesus kept silent, and the high priest answered and said to him, 'I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God.' And Jesus said to him, 'It is as you said.'" So he's saying, "Yeah, I am. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming in the clouds of heaven." And you notice how Son of God is what he's called in verse 63, and then Jesus switches it and he says Son of Man. These are interchangeable terms, and both of them refer to Jesus as deity. But anyway, it was obvious that this guy thought that the Messiah was the Son of God. They just didn't think it was Jesus, okay? Somewhere between the resurrection of Jesus and today, the Jews flipped. And my guess is it's because it's just too much of a Christian thing to believe that the Messiah is the Son of God. But somewhere along the line, they flipped on that. And today, most, if not all of them, do not believe that Jesus is the Son of God, or that the Messiah is the Son of God. Okay, now, to prove that Jesus is the Son of God to a Jewish person, you've got to use Old Testament scripture. And one of the best ones on this is 2 Samuel chapter 7. Whoops. Okay, chapter 7, verse 11. This is the Davidic covenant. And this occurs 1,000 years before the Apostle Paul. And by the way, one of their reasonings on why the Messiah is not the Son of God, because they think the Apostle Paul invented Christianity. And that what he did in inventing Christianity was that he merged Roman pagan religion with Judaism. And this hybrid is called Christianity. And all these old gods like Zeus and all this stuff, these people were themselves, or these gods were themselves children of other gods, and then they would have baby gods. And so they think that this is a merger, that Christianity is a merger of that plus Judaism. But, where am I at? Oh, 2 Samuel. Okay. So here we are at the Davidic covenant, chapter 7, verse 11. Since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel and have cursed you to rest from all your enemies. Oh, caused you to rest from all my enemies. Also, the Lord tells you that he will make you a house. Now, when you read that, you can read it two ways. Either a house being a lineage of children and descendants, or an actual house, the temple. Also, the Lord tells you that he will make you a house. He's talking to David here. When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body. And I will establish his kingdom. Okay, now we're talking about the Messiah. Somebody from his body, a biological descendant, and he's going to set up his kingdom, whoever this seed is. And it says, he shall build a house for my name. Now that's Jesus. Jesus had no physical descendants. So the house he's talking about has to be the temple. And the temple that Jesus is going to build is going to show up in the millennial reign. He's going to build that. And that's in Ezekiel 40 through 48. And it says, he shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son. There it is. God will be the father. The son will be the Messiah, the person that comes from David's seed. And I will chasten him with the rod of men. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. Yeah, now some people would say, well, this seed that comes after is Solomon, because he was the next one born. But Solomon, even though he sinned a lot, yeah, that is an understatement. But nevertheless, he sinned a lot, but he never got chastened by anybody. Eventually, the Messiah, Jesus, would come and take his punishment for him. But anyway, in verse 15, but my mercy shall not depart from him as I took it from Saul, whom I removed from before you. So even though the Messiah is going to be the bearer of the sin of all mankind, he's not going to lose the mercy of God because of that. And verse 16, in your house and your kingdom, he's talking to David, the kingdom of David, the kingdom of David's house, shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever. Again, only the Messiah, who's God, can handle that, because all these other kings died. David died, Solomon died, they all died. When the Jewish rabbis see the word forever, they insert there 70 years. And you think, how in the world can you get forever to mean 70 years? It's because there was a, because when Hezekiah was given extra life, it was mentioned there that his seed would last forever. And but the Davidic line ended with Jeconiah, or actually his one of his brothers or an uncle or whatever it was, but that ended in their way of calculating 70 years after that point. But when you try to add those up, I don't know how they come up with 70, but that's what they do. So they say it's, it means 70 years. But you notice all this comes way before the Apostle Paul. So Paul couldn't have made that one up. Then we can go to 1 Chronicles. Where am I going here? Chronicles. 1 Chronicles. Chapter 28. Verse 5. 1 Chronicles 28:5, and it says, "And of all my sons, for the Lord has given me many sons, he has chosen my son Solomon to sit on the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel." Now you notice what that's called. My son Solomon to sit on the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel. That's a pretty hefty title. And evidently, all of these kings had that title. It's the kingdom of the Lord over Israel. It's not the kingdom of Israel. It's the kingdom of the Lord over Israel. And eventually, over all the whole world and over every Gentile nation. "And he said to me, 'It is your son Solomon who shall build my house and my courts.' And yes, Solomon did build a temple. 'For I have chosen him to be my son, and I will be his father. Moreover, I will establish his kingdom forever.'" Now, wait a minute. Now we're drifting off into something a little bit different. Solomon is now a sort of a metaphor of the coming Messiah, because Solomon didn't last forever. His temple didn't last forever. His kingdom didn't last forever. "If he is steadfast to observe my commandments and my judgments as it is this day." Let's see. I think we can stop there. No, we'll keep going. "Now, therefore, in the sight of all Israel, the assembly of the Lord, and in the hearing of our God, be careful to seek out all the commandments of the Lord your God, that you may possess this good land and live and leave it as an inheritance for your children after you forever. As for you, my son Solomon, know that the God of your father, and serve him with a loyal heart and a willing mind, for the Lord searches all hearts and understands all the intents of the thoughts. If you seek him, he will be found by you, but if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever. Consider now, for the Lord has chosen you to build a house for the sanctuary. Be strong and do it." Okay, he's back to talking to Solomon as a normal person again. Now we can go to Ezekiel. And Ezekiel chapter 43 especially. Actually, 40 through 48 has a lot of nifty stuff in it. It's one of the more boring sections of the Bible because in chapter 40, verse 4 of Ezekiel, Ezekiel is ordered by God to declare the house of Israel everything you see. Declare to the house of Israel everything you see. So what he's supposed to do, he's been given a vision or he's been transported to the future. I don't know which, but he's going to be allowed to go into this temple, this future temple. And he's told by God to write down every single thing he sees. And he does. He tells you about the windows and the porches and the kitchens and the steps and the pillars and the posts and the designs carved into the wall. And he tells you how high they all are and how long they all are and all this stuff. And that's why it's tedious. And that's why it's tough to read. But when you read through all this stuff, you will notice that there is no mention of many things that you would expect to be in a temple. For example, there's no menorah in the future temple, in the millennial temple. There's no table of showbread, no altar of incense, no high priest is mentioned. The veil of separation, there's no such thing in this new temple. Blood is not allowed to go into the temple. Whereas in the Old Testament, blood was brought in once a year to put on the mercy seat, which sat above the Ark of the Covenant. And so those sins of the people were covered for a year. But in this temple, there's not even an ark. There is no ark. Instead, there's a throne sitting in the Holy of Holies. And that would be David's throne. And so this temple, what it does in symbolic ways is it teaches New Testament theology, that we can go into the throne of God boldly and receive grace in a time of need. In Old Testament times, you couldn't do that. Here's something else. Let me make sure I got my right stuff here. We'll read a little bit more in chapter 43. In fact, we'll go to 43. Chapter 43 of Ezekiel, chapter 43, verse 1. Afterwards, he brought me to the gate that faces towards the east. And behold, the glory of God, the glory of the God of Israel, came from the way of the east. His voice was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory. Now, he's entering not the old temple. He's not entering the tribulation temple. He's entering the millennial temple. Okay? A lot of people get that wrong. When he goes through the east gate, see, today the east gate's plugged up because the Muslims heard this story and they think the Messiah is going to go in there, so they put stones in there and bricked it all up. Like that's going to stop him. But that temple won't even exist. The tribulation temple won't exist. It will be destroyed before this. Jesus will build the millennial temple and then he'll go in the east gate of the millennial temple. Verse 3. It was like the appearance of the vision which I saw. This is Ezekiel talking, so he had a vision here. Like the vision which I saw when I came to destroy the city. The visions were like the vision which I saw by the river Chebar, and I fell on my face. And the glory of the Lord came into the temple by way of the gate which faces towards the east. The Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court. And behold, the glory of the Lord filled the temple. So these are things that Ezekiel saw in this future temple. Then I heard him, and that him there would be God. See, the glory entered the temple with God, or it is God. And so now God's in the temple, and from the temple, God speaks to Ezekiel. And he says, I heard him speaking to me from the temple while a man stood by me. I don't know who that is, but anyway. Verse 7, and he said to me, Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet. Now, God the Father and God the Holy Spirit don't even have feet. They're spirits. But Jesus has feet, and there's nail holes in his feet. Even to this day, and he'll have that forever. He did that for us. But God, as we read right here in verse 7, very clearly says to Ezekiel that it's God, and God says, my throne is in that temple. So this is the Davidic throne, and only God can sit on that throne. So if the Messiah isn't God, there is no Messiah. Let's see here. Okay. So, back to verse 7. Soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever. No more shall the house of Israel defile my holy name. They nor their kings. So Israel's still going to have kings, but they won't be the king. By their harlotry or with the carcasses of their kings on their high places. When they set their threshold by my threshold and their doorpost by my doorpost, with a wall between them and me, they defiled my holy name by the abominations which they committed. Therefore, I have consumed them in my anger. Now let them put their harlotry and the carcasses of their kings far away from me, and I will dwell in their midst forever. Son of man, describe the temple of the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the pattern. And if they are ashamed and all of all that they have done, make known to them the design of the temple and the arrangement, its exits, its entrance, its entire design with all of its ordinances, all of its forms, and all of its laws. Write it down in their sight so that they may keep its whole design and all of its ordinances and perform them. This is the law of the temple. Now you notice what it doesn't say. This is not the law of Moses. This is not the old covenant. This is the law of the temple, which evidently is the law of the new and everlasting covenant. So this temple is a visible, I guess it's sort of an established, you know, here it is. This is the new and everlasting covenant. Now we're already in on that ourselves. The new and everlasting covenant was promised in Jeremiah 31, and it was for Israel, but Israel as a group rejected it. But God's not, you know, he's still going to save people. So it actually gets, the new and everlasting covenant has started, but we're like the early birds. We get in on it early, but at the second coming, then all this, the temple and the high, and Jesus being the high priest sitting on that throne on earth amongst the Jews, all of that's still future. Then the last thing we can look at here. Whoops. Okay. The last thing that the Jewish people reject about Jesus is that there's a contradiction between what's taught in the book of Hebrews about no more sacrifice and what it says in Ezekiel 45 and 46, where sacrifices are clearly mentioned. And there will be sacrifices in the millennium. Let's see if I can find one here real quick. 45:22. There's one. And on the day the prince shall prepare himself and for all the people of the land a bull for a sin offering. And then I think we got some more in 46. Well, if you read through those chapters, you'll find out.
Verse 23 also, it says right after 22.
It's like several. Yeah, on 7 days of the feast, he shall prepare a burnt offering to the Lord, 7 bulls and 7 rams without blemish daily for 7 days, and a kid of the goats for a daily sin offering. Yeah. And you got more sacrifices than that going on throughout the whole millennial reign. So how do we deal with that? So in Hebrews, you have no more sacrifices being taught. And in Ezekiel, you got more sacrifices. So the Jewish rabbis will say, see, you got a problem there. The New Testament's wrong. But these new sacrifices, some people teach that they are a memorial of what Jesus did in the past. They do not expiate sin. That's the main thing. the future sacrifices have nothing to do with sin. What Jesus did on the cross is takes care of all the sin problem. Another guy that I just happened to come across by luck, he claims that it's a cleansing ceremony to remind people that they are still sinners. Because the people during the millennial reign will still be sinners. And they will have to have a Messiah who will pay the full penalty of their sins as well. And they'll have to be born again, just like we are. But these people are going to be very, very nice people. There's not going to be a whole lot of sin in the millennial reign. There will be some, but not much. And anyway, I thought that was interesting. He sees it as a reminder of your current sin, because people are going to be regular, ordinary people will be going in and out of this temple, and they'll be able to go right through into the Holy of Holies, which is yet again a New Testament teaching. So, I think we ought to wrap it up there.